We're talking to Pat McEwen. He is a comic artist who's been toiling away on a graphic novel for years. But we're going to talk about your early work and go right on through to the end.
Okay.
When did you start drawing?
Drawing or drawing professionally?
Just drawing.
In earnest, probably when I was about 12, like comics specifically 12, but I mean I've been drawing since I was like 7, 6, something like that. My older brother drew a lot and read a lot of comic books, so I think at first I was just emulating him, and you know, gradually he stopped and I just kept going. So
as a child, did you think you would have a comic book career?
I don't think I ever thought about it in terms of career. It just sort of materialized. It was just something I did all the time. So when opportunities arose, I just sort of jumped at them. And it, yeah. But no, it wasn't like I didn't have a burning ambition to be a cartoonist. It was just something that I did a lot. And I worked in a comic book store, so it was just really present in my life. Mm-hmm. So
what store was that?
It was a place called Arthur's in Ottawa, which was a pretty seedy secondhand book and record store, and they also sold men's magazines, and it was, yeah, it was
sounds perfect.
Yeah, it was pretty, yeah, it was quite a place.
So you got involved with Aircel at a pretty young age, like was
yeah.
that 16, I'm not sure.
It was 1985. I mean, Barry Blair was doing stuff prior to that. Like, okay. I would have been about 12 when I met him through Dave Cooper. And he was producing a bunch of zine things. You know, pretty slickly published things.
Was he doing the Elf stuff then?
Yeah, it was Elf Lord. Elf Lord. Yeah, just... when they say it out loud,
yeah,
it's pretty funny.
As someone who works in comic book stores,
yeah.
I see that stuff all the time.
Yeah, well, that's too bad. but it was one of those things. There was nothing else going on at the time, and it, when you're 12 or 13, it seems like, wow, you know, this guy's making it happen. And I guess, yeah, like around 1985, he was working in insulation, and the grant that the company had was running out, and the guy who ran the company was looking for a new business venture, and Barry convinced him that comic books would be a good way to go.
And was it?
Well,
you guys were pretty prolific.
Yeah, well, there wasn't a lot of quality control, unfortunately. It was taking advantage of the glut in the black and white market and the explosion of independent comic books. So it was kind of a strange time. It was really a speculative economy. And, I mean, it happened again in the 90s with all the Todd McFarlane crap.
Mm-hmm.
But that initial boom, yeah, it lasted for about 3 years. And we were publishing a retarded amount of material. And
what did you start doing? Were you just inking, or did you go straight to drawing? Or?
God, it was never really clearly defined. It was we were kind of doing a little bit of everything, depending on what needed to be done.
And that was at the age of 13?
A little bit at that point, but it wasn't, the professional thing didn't happen until I was 17. So, but it was sort of always going in some respect. Like Barry was always producing something, and I think Dave and I drifted away when we were about 13 or 14, but then we came back when money became an issue, and neither of us were particularly, I guess, committed to school or anything like that, and so the first opportunity we had to work full-time in what we thought was a great field, you know, kind of jumped at it, so it seemed pretty exciting at the time. But again, there was a lot of momentum and not a lot of looking at what we were doing, but things were emerging around us, things like Yummy Fur and trying to think of what else was kind of good at the time. Raw was happening.
There was also like the ElfQuest stuff and
yeah,
the Kamiko and the Eclipse. And
yeah, Eclipse had some good stuff. I remember Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers, and there were a few other things, but none of it really lasted. Like none, you know, most of that stuff is kind of a footnote today.
Mm-hmm.
I guess a few things might have Yeah, there's nothing from that initial black and white glut that I can really recall. It's probably just as well. I think a lot of that... A lot
Cerebus,
of that,
come on.
Well, yeah. I'm not going to go there with you, but... I would say most of that stuff just ended up being like farm team stuff for the majors. Not too many people had a real committed vision of something exceptionally different from what was going on in the mainstream. It did sort of open it up to be the kind of more cinema-friendly thing that it is today, I think, and it definitely changed things for creators and gave creators a lot more leverage because it did prove to be competition for the big companies.
Mm-hmm.
But they did get around that by just sort of hiring those people. So,
smart way.
You know, they kind of co-opted into it. So, yeah, whatever spirit of independence was going on, I don't know, it seems to be, yeah, I've been just kind of absorbed.
When did you do Underground?
That was mid-period Aircell, and I think we were doing well enough for them to entertain the idea of something that was a little less genre-oriented, although the book's still pretty tied up in genre conventions, and it's pretty melodramatic, but it was an attempt on my part to integrate something that was close to my day-to-day reality, something, you know, verging on autobiography, but mm-hmm. it's still pretty heavily fictionalized. I'd spent a little bit of time in London at that point, but I think so, or maybe that was just before. So it's kind of, you know, it's a little less genre-oriented than something like Baker Street,
mm-hmm.
but it's still pretty... in Cohate. I don't know. It's
well, it was the time period that you were growing up in. Yeah. It's not like it was just totally off the top of your head.
No, I mean...
And I'd imagine after doing all those elves, you wanted something you could relate to.
Yeah, well, there was always an impulse to do that, and it had sort of infiltrated some of the other stuff, like the action titles like Samurai, and I tried to take that in a more, I don't know, artsy direction. It was kind of misguided and pretty pretentious in a lot of ways, but there were some things brewing that have definitely come to play in more recent work in a much more kind of mature way. I'd say the graphic novel that I'm working on now has some striking resemblances to earlier work, which I was surprised to see. I'm like, wow, I'm still working with a lot of the same themes. But
you try to exonerate them, I guess.
Yeah.
It's a catharsis.
Totally. I mean, just not having the vocabulary at the time to really, or the perspective on the experience to really frame it in a way that seems believable or...
Well, to me,
mature.
It's kind of special. I mean, it's the snapshot of Canadiana that there's not really anything like it at the time. Like, seriously.
No, it's true.
Dave wasn't doing anything like that.
No.
Yummy Fur isn't close to that at all.
No.
I mean, like, what other Canadian alternative independent comic was coming out at the time that encompassed that sort of scene?
No, it's true. And, you know, I've had kind of, I don't know how you'd describe it, but I have peers in the industry who are fond of it. They kind of tease me about it, but it was something
that's so heartfelt. Like, yeah, even the inside front cover is like all cut and paste your name.
Yeah. It was pretty, yeah, never mind the bollocks. I didn't do that part. I think that was Mike Charbonneau. I think I art directed some of that stuff, and they pulled my back cover. They put that stupid photo on the back, unbeknownst to me, because the back
cover... Are you guys in the French Metro, or where is it?
No,
the London?
That's New York.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, that really pissed me off, because the back cover I had was the guy getting punched through the back of the head, and they pulled it at the last minute, I think. They justified it as, can't remember, responding to a concern of the printers or
mm-hmm.
something like that, but they were pretty underhanded that way. They'd sort of say, oh yeah, everything's fine to your face, and then...
I get the impression that a lot of these early independent Canadian publishers were really fly-by-night. I've heard the same kind of stories from Bernie Moreau.
Totally, and a lot of the American guys, Bernie and I both got caught up in the Cameco thing, and when they got bought up by, I think it was Andrew Rev, there were all kinds of just parasites, you know, people who didn't really know much about business, and they were eager to take advantage of a property and try and exploit it to, you know, to the extent that they could. And so there were all kinds of shady business practices. I won't go into it, but it was, you know, none of these guys are around today, but I think a lot of naive young guys like me and Bernie were really willing, wanted to believe that these guys had our best interests at heart, or the medium for that matter, much less the business. You know, we were inclined to sort of buy the line up to a point, but when it got to people like Andrew Rev, it just became the predatory nature of it. Mm-hmm. And this notion of these this legion of publishers who were just, they had no place in the business or the medium at all, and they were just looking to find a way to make money.
Quick buck, yeah.
So it was pretty gross.
When did you and Aircel part ways?
It happened a couple of times. There were several kind of restructurings of the company as the independent glut sort of waxed and waned. And there were a lot of internal struggles about the direction the company should be going, and also productivity. So I guess it was 87. Yeah, it was when I left for good. But I'd been laid off and then called back once. It happened. There was like a brief coup in the company at one point that I wasn't really part of. It was a really kind of turbulent time. And but, you know, in retrospect, a tempest in a teacup. So, yeah, it was kind of ridiculous. The people at the helm had no idea how to run a business, but...
How does it make you feel to realize that Barry Blair is still publishing his Elf stuff?
Is he?
He doesn't publish it himself, but okay. It is still coming out. It's okay. MBM has published the last couple of books. Yeah, they're I don't know, you know, sometimes I look at those comics and I really wonder about Mr. Blair. I don't want to tell tales out of school, but there's a lot of prepubescent Elf children running around. I find it mildly disturbing, actually.
Well, yeah, it's a controversial topic, and not one that I feel like I can expand on, because it doesn't just involve me, and there are other people's privacy to take into account. But, you know, nothing illegal went on.
Oh, no, I'm not suggesting that in the least.
No, but, you know, I'll just, you know, let the material speak for itself.
It's very interesting.
Yeah. But he's not quite the bad guy that everybody makes him out to be.
Oh, I'm not making him out to be. I don't even know anything about him.
I just mean he's been much maligned in the press, and some of it is well-deserved, but he has redeeming qualities. And actually, Dave Cooper and I sort of touched on it in, Dave's interview in the Comics Journal.
Yep, so, I was reading that. Yeah.
Okay, so if anybody's kind of
interested. That's online. That's a great interview, because it's not so much an interview as it is a conversation between you guys. It's like, because usually interview is a give and a take, right? But you give a lot as well as the interviewer, not just Dave.
I think that's what Dave wanted, because he was a little apprehensive about doing the interview, and he didn't really want it to be... a typical interview. He wanted it to be a little bit more organic, and I don't think he wanted all the attention to be on him. It sort of comes out. It's a very long, drawn-out interview, and a couple of people have sort of given me backhanded compliments about it, or, you know, about maybe...
Well, maybe because I'm just a big nerd, but I loved it. I was like, this is great. This is like, I'm there. You're describing it completely. Yeah. Like, it's not... And it's two different perspectives, right? It's not just, you know, one-sided. So.
Yeah, well, and I think Dave wanted to avoid just the typical fan questions. So we tried to address things that lay people would want to know, or fans, but it was kind of... more, setting up a conversation where the stuff would just sort of come out if you were inclined to look for it.
Mm-hmm. So, speaking of Dave Cooper, when did you get involved with Gavin McInnes and Pervert? Because it's kind of incestuous. Like, I was actually going to include Bob Fingerman in that triptych as well.
Well, yeah, Bob doesn't have any dealings with Gavin at all, but I knew Gavin and Bob.
And was Ron Turner involved in this as well?
Ron Turner, yeah, not really.
Okay, just clarifying.
Yeah, Ron was specifically a BC chapter of the whole affair, but Gavin I knew vaguely from the Ottawa scene. He was a friend of friends, and he didn't really get in touch with me until after I'd moved to BC, and he had been in a couple of bands in Ottawa, Leather Ass Butt Fuck and Anal Chinook, which I'd never seen, but I knew him as a person, and sort of a fixture on the scene. He seemed to me at the time to be a bit of a tourist, and he kind of came in at the late part of it for me, but because he had never lived in one of the communal houses or, you know, any of the, he hadn't really been involved in any of the early phases of it, but he he came on strong, and he had a big influence on the later phases of the scene, so, and clearly in the zine community. But once I'd moved to BC in the early 90s, he, I guess, became aware of my career as a cartoonist, and he didn't pursue me or anything like that, but he initiated, you know, some communication, and through a mutual friend we got to know each other a bit better. Dave didn't come into the picture until later, and I think Gavin might have met him through me or independently of me in Ottawa, but it was after I was gone. Yeah, Gavin used to travel a fair bit. I remember he came out to Vancouver at one point when he was still, when Pervert was still going. We jammed on a thing there, and I can't remember if I did the stuff for him before or after that, or, you know, coincided with that. And somewhere in between that and the beginning of Vice, I made a couple of trips to Montreal, and he had, you know, tried to convince Dave and I separately and together to kind of get on board with an early publishing venture. And I think Dave and I were both hustling in the freelance thing and trying to make names for ourselves in the independent scene and in the mainstream. And Gavin's thing did seem a little bit fly by night. And I think we were wary because of people like Andrew Rev and Barry Blair, that we wanted to see something
before you committed.
Yeah, just to see if he was going to be sticking around and if he was committed to what he was doing. And I can't speak for Dave, but my own commitments kind of took me in a different direction. I still did stuff with Gavin, but I wasn't able to really jump on board with it. And he'd initially proposed the record label, and that was his, or no, I can't remember. He had an idea about the record label around the same time he had the idea for the tabloid, which they were working for The Voice, which was a welfare project, an employment project for people on welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when it got into trouble financially, they just did a hostile takeover. And again, I think Dave and I were sort of invited in, but failed to take him up on it. I guess it just didn't seem
Dave
right.
Well, Dave did contribute a bunch of Pip and Norton comics.
Yeah, that was later, after it had sort of established itself. He and Gavin had a much more in-depth relationship in terms of collaboration, but that was after the, it had gone from a tabloid to a magazine in New York. But we both contributed strips to it when it was a tabloid. And they switched from The Voice to Vice, and then they went to New York. But really, my only presence in that magazine for the longest time was the horoscope icons.
Okay.
And I did some stuff more recently. I designed some toys and did some illustration, but Dave was pretty consistent in his contributions, as far as I know.
Pervert would be the beginning of that,
yeah,
relationship.
Pervert was, and it was fun. I look back on my contributions, and I feel like it sort of missed the mark. I was kind of in my own little world in Vancouver, and it didn't really have that much to do with a lot of the other stuff. Gavin was really involved in the zine scene, and especially the bande dessinée thing here in Montreal. And so there were a lot of comic jams with a lot of independent cartoonists, but yeah, I mean, he had his sights set on much bigger things, so it was just sort of a phase in his thing. But he always maintained a respect for it, and he helped a lot of his friends out later.
Oh yeah, he's very supportive of the comic industry, which is great.
Yeah.
So. When did you get involved with Matt Wagner?
That was in Montreal in the late 80s. So after Aircell folded, I came to Montreal just to live with an old roommate, and I wasn't doing much. But I bumped into Bernie Moreau, and he mentioned that he just finished up a stint on Grendel, and that Matt was looking for an artist, and that Matt was actually here in Montreal. His wife, Barb, is from Montreal, and Diana Schutz was, I guess, with Kimiko. Yeah, they were,
yeah.
Sorry, I'm kind of losing track. It's 20 years ago.
It's okay.
So she was still married to Bob Schreck, and I remember having a meeting with Matt separately and then with all four of them, and Yeah, and I got the job doing Grendel.
That was War Child?
Yeah. It hadn't been named yet. It was still just Grendel. It's the next chapter of Grendel. Tim Sale was still wrapping up his pages.
Was it scary going to something, like, way more slick?
No, because it really wasn't at the time.
Like, it's only now in retrospect it seems way more slick.
Yeah. Well, at Cameco it was still kind of, I guess Bill Willingham was their only mm-hmm. other big guy, and, you know, Matt had made his name doing that, but... Bernie's was the only chapter that I'd really read. I hadn't.
I'm a big fan of the Panda Brothers stuff
yeah,
as well.
I'm kind of ambivalent about those guys. There are things about it that I like, but I never read them because there wasn't really any storytelling per se.
Were you reading comics back then, or were you still kind of like your too cool for punk kind
of? No, I mean, I've always read comics, but I've always been kind of... particular about it. I was never aligned with a particular series. I would get obsessed with particular artists or writers for mm-hmm. a while, but
back then, who was influencing you?
It's hard for me to recall. There was a lot of stuff in the mainstream, obviously, but I think because I'd gotten into it so early, 12, 13, and my taste had been shaped by people a lot older than me. So I was still kind of reaching back, and there wasn't a lot of stuff. Like, people like John K. Snyder and the Panda Brothers just didn't do it for me at all, because I thought the storytelling was pretty awful.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're pretty bombastic and definitely,
yeah.
like, a what's the word? They're definitely iconically 80s, like, and I saw
yeah,
both those
totally,
guys, Snyder
totally.
And the Panda Brothers.
Well, and I think it's, like, styles that really didn't transcend that. And
no, I well, know. that's one of the reasons why
yeah.
I kind of like it.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, I'm not, like,
yeah.
that wasn't my time period, but
yeah.
at the same time, like, it's really different when you compare it to the standard mainstream,
yeah.
you know, Marvel yeah. or DC that was coming out at the time.
Yeah, I guess...
It's really style heavy though,
yeah.
you know, the shoulder pads are out to here, and
yeah.
the chins and
yeah.
eyes are really angular. And
yeah, well, again, because I wasn't invested in that kind of stuff very much, I felt pressure to conform because people
oh,
had expectations about the series, but it just wasn't, it was never going to be something I was going to attempt, so
mm-hmm.
I was still... People like Mobius, yeah. in terms of genre stuff, I always look to like Corbin and Mobius, because
mm-hmm.
I'd been seeing heavy metal since 1977.
Okay.
So I was about nine. Yeah, I was nine when my brother brought home the first issues. So a lot of the European guys had a really prominent influence on me from an early age. So
you were just talking about how heavy metal influenced you.
Yeah, it was a formative thing because it happened when I was about nine and my brother brought them home around that time. So pretty, yeah, it's probably a little early to be exposed to that kind of material, but also National Lampoon part of that. And you were just mentioning Bill Ward in Crack magazine and how weird that was.
Yeah.
And
well, Lampoon was pretty, like, I've got a couple issues of the comic book specials.
It was pretty pornographic.
That's, well,
yeah.
there was like a lot of early yeah. Bon Baudets in there,
mm-hmm.
and like it's all over the map.
Yeah, I remember seeing some fairly confusing things. But having seen them in retrospect many years later, it's kind of...
Do you think that formed your art, not style, but just like your sensibilities, like what you want to write about, what you're passionate about? Because I have to say, a lot of
yeah.
what you illustrate has a really dark sort of tinge to it when you consider the thing that you did in Flinch. I mean, I know it was written
yeah.
by Bob
yeah,
Fingerman,
yeah.
but then also the zombie world that you co-wrote with Mike Mignola. And
oh, yeah, and when the graphic novel comes out for Gallimard, it's, you know, still, although it's geared for an adolescent readership, that was commissioned specifically for an adolescent readership, it still deals with some fairly dark and difficult subject matter, albeit through, again, the lens of melodrama, so it's still kind of beholden to the conventions of melodrama, but I think there's, you know, it's getting in a pretty dark subtext,
mm-hmm.
so, yeah, it's always there, and I don't think you could locate it in National Lampoon specifically. I think that's just symptomatic of other things.
The time.
Yeah, lots of circumstances, and nothing, no single thing specifically. So, and it's not that I had a very dark childhood or anything like that. But I've always been interested in the things that are unspoken and the things that are repressed. And there was a time in independent comics where that was seen as regressive, and it was like kind of ghettoized.
Mm-hmm.
immature and just shock material, but I think time has come where a more considered approach to it will be kind of accepted. But I remember guys like Joe Matt and Chester and Seth were, and the sort of the orthodoxy of independent cartoonists, mostly men, who were trying to distance themselves from genre stuff and wanting to appear more urbane, would kind of poo-poo stuff that dealt with, I guess, what they saw as more puerile material. And I think they were right up to a point, but I think the baby got thrown out with the bathwater there for a while, and it, as a result, independent comics became kind of detached from their subject, and you can see it.
Well, it was just like the black and white boom. You've got a sudden glut of everyone unloading their neurosis.
Yeah, well, and a lot of repressed and really immature stuff that wasn't, you know, well thought out or, you know, didn't have the time to gestate. And
is that why you refrained from doing a lot of autobio? Because most of what you've written hasn't been autobiographical at all.
It was tough, mostly because I felt people that I knew, like the guys I just mentioned, plus Chris Ware and Dan Close and Julie Doucet and a lot of the emerging women writers, had just done a lot of the things that I wanted to do, and I didn't really see where I could contribute in an original way. It's just taken a while for me to kind of find my place. And around that time, I was sort of frustrated with the orthodoxy that did arise for a while, and it was sort of like, this is good, this is not good, and people were sort of picking teams, and the fact that I worked in the mainstream made it difficult. It was also a question of finding the time to do it, because I couldn't make any money doing that, and that shouldn't be the deciding factor, but at the same time, I was really struggling to stay afloat financially, and I was spending a lot of time with guys in Seattle like Jason Lutz and Ed Brubaker and John Lewis and Tom Hart and Megan Kelso, and they were all doing, you know, pretty much autobiographical stuff. You know, I collaborated with Ed on the one short piece for DHP, which was really fun. I did some stuff for John Lewis. And all of this, I wanted to do more personal work all the time, but I was always really just struggling to get by and wasn't...
Well, the other thing, too, that I've noticed in your career is that you've been very focused on your education as well. Did you start that when you were doing Grendel, or did that come after?
Well, yeah, I started Grendel when I was in Montreal in the late 80s, and then I moved to BC to be with my girlfriend of the time, and as soon as I got out to BC, Cameco went under, and I was laid off for about a year and a half, and while Matt and Diana were shopping Grendel around to various publishers, Dark Horse eventually picked it up, but there was a legal wrangling with this guy, Andrew Rev, who'd taken over Cameco, and he was asserting his right over the property, which he didn't really have any legal right to, but that was... In that time, I went back to school. I was doing college radio at the time. I was doing some public affairs programming and a couple of music shows, and I ended up being music director.
With who, like CKUT or...?
CFUV in Victoria.
Oh, in Victoria, okay.
So... And through that, I ended up enrolling in school because I got a job in the graphics shop in the student union building, and I needed to be a student. Mm-hmm. So I went back to school. I'd already gone back once in Ottawa at Carleton University, and while I was with AirCell still, did a couple of courses part-time. And then in Victoria, I went back again, began my fine arts degree. Undeclared, but then Dark Horse picked up Grendel and went back to that full time until that was finished. And I kind of crapped out on issue 11 because it was just burned out. I'd really put everything I had into it, and I think I'd started seeing some of the inks at that time, and Matt Wagner was supposed to ink it, but he was handing a lot of it off to his assistant Monty, who was still learning. And I think that was a bit of a heartbreaker for me, because I'd put a lot into that.
But they've recently redone it. Have you seen these?
Redone them how?
I don't know if they're re-inking or recoloring, but I know
they might have recolored some of them, but...
I know they're re-releasing them, and they've revamped them with the re-release.
No, I haven't seen them. I haven't heard anything about it either, so that's news to me. But they couldn't... unless they retrace the whole thing. I can't imagine them re-inking them.
Yeah.
Unless they've just been redrawn altogether, I don't know.
I don't think they would go that far. They're probably just recoloring them.
Yeah, probably.
When did you do Homecoming? Was that right after, or...?
It was a few years after. I was in Vancouver by that point. That was in a weird in-between stage. That was around the time that I was trying to find stuff in between the more mainstream stuff and
Did
the independent
any?
Stuff. Little bits here and there, but nothing substantial. I was working for Disney Adventures at that point because I was just sick of the action-adventure thing. I did a Hellblazer fill-in. I did a pin-up. A few things here and there. I was living off royalties from Grendel at that point. Or no, that was later. That was... little later, yeah. And that was around the time that I met Ron Turner, and we were doing TikTok and some other sort of zine things, but I can't quite remember. I think Disney Adventures was paying the bills at that point. Yeah, I can't really remember exactly what was going on there.
But then you did Homecoming?
Yeah, right around that time. And
wasn't Dave Cooper inking for you?
Or? He was inking and coloring, yeah. So he was basically, I was penciling them and then he was painting them mm-hmm. by hand, so, and Matt was sort
was
of...
Was he still in Ottawa and you were in Vancouver?
Yeah, that's how that went down.
And it'd be fair to mention that there was no internet at this point.
No.
You no. guys were snail mailing them to each other.
Yeah, I mean, all of that stuff was going on at that time. It was all really invested in paper and regular mail. And at that point, that was when I was hanging around with the guys in Seattle a lot. So, but not really making any concerted effort to generate something of my own. I think I was in too much of an interval period. I was carrying on a long-distance relationship with somebody in New York at that point, too, so...
That's sick. You're on the other side of the country.
Well, yeah, I know. We'd moved to Vancouver together from Victoria, and then she'd been accepted late to grad school. And that was like a three-year on-and-off thing, which eventually took me to Brooklyn for a year. And that's where I was already friends with Bob Fingerman, and...
How did you meet Bob?
I wrote to him because he'd done the Lydia Lunch comic and
that's awesome.
Some other stuff, probably for the Eros line.
Yeah.
But I remembered his stuff from Special USA, a bande dessinée from France, which had his Rangs Rocks parody.
Oh, okay.
And
I've never seen that. He'd be really perfect for that, though.
And some other punk rock stuff, or punk rock related
stuff.
Yeah,
like Skinheads in Love.
Yeah, that's the one. And I think Dave Cooper was doing his Eero stuff at the time, so that was... Yeah, I think that's where that one started, and through him I got to know, sort of that group of people like Steve DiStefano, Robbie Bush, Greg Benton was working at Disney Adventures at that time, and Heidi McDonald was
now,
my editor.
Now, how come you never did any of the big books?
I was approached at one point, and I...
Because those are all people who've contributed a lot to the big books.
I think I might have had an opportunity if I'd pursued it, but I was either doing something else, or it just didn't come around. I don't really know.
When did you start doing the animation? How did you get involved? Was that through Disney?
No, that was directly through Steve DiStefano, who was working on Superman at the time. And
that'd be Superman Adventures?
Yeah. And he put me in touch with Sean McLaughlin. I'd come back from New York at that point, my relationship, and I'd broken up with my girlfriend and I had broken up, so I was coming back to Canada and I really needed to turn things around because I wanted more stable, steady work and something that would pay more. And I was really pretty tired of the comic book landscape at that point. So.
But it's so funny because it's not like you've got a glut of work out there. Like, it's just been, to me, it's been kind of dribs and drabs, but I could...
I was never really committed to it.
Yeah.
Or to the business. Not what I was doing, anyways.
You know, like, if you were Matt Wagner, who did this creation for, like, 20 years, I could see how one would get really tired really quick.
Well... You know, I just always had other interests, and that was part of the thing about going back to school, and I think in a lot of ways I'm much better suited to storyboarding than comic books.
Did you go to school for animation, or was it learn as you go when you got there?
Oh, no. Storyboarding was just, it's a lot like comic books. And all kinds of stuff had happened in between. I mean, I'd done Zombie World with Mike Mignola.
Okay, so the storyboarding came later.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, I was under the impression that you were doing it at the same time. So tell me about Zombie World then, because you co-created that with Mike. How did you meet Mike?
Yeah, I met Mike in Victoria at a convention years before. It's all kind of detailed in the foreword to the last reissue of Zombie World. But he had just finished Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser for DC's, but I'd really enjoyed that, and met him at a convention. We just sort of hit it off, and he had a sketch of Hellboy in a really early stage, and I didn't really meet him again until years later, but on one of my returns from New York, I was back in Vancouver and doing some work for Dark Horse through Scott Alley. I think I did the Mask Adventures for Titan around that point, and Scott was brokering that project, and he called me about potentially working with Mike on something, and I said yes, and then Mike and I just hammered it out.
Well, one of the things I wanted to talk about is it seems almost in between like Zombie World and Homecoming that your art style sort of changes and that you get this really polished, cutesy look where everything's a little bit exaggerated. I would have assumed that came about from working in animation. When did that happen? How did that happen? Yeah. What was the impetus?
That was probably a lot of things. It was around that time that I was drifting away from mainstream comic books. I mean, I was always interested in what was going on in independent comics, but there was a lot of graphics and a lot of more comic strip art, you know, from the 10s and 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people like Hergé, obviously, a lot of the French Clear Line stuff, people like Yves Chalon.
Yes, I was just going to mention him for sure.
And Serge Clerc, who were guys, again, from heavy metal from, you know, the 70s and 80s that were kind of coming back for me. And it was kind of, I guess my whole thing with the industry has been, I've always felt really beholden to the craft of comics, so I've constantly been kind of playing around with different elements of the craft, but sort of too beholden to the craft to ever take a lot of risks or experiment much until later. And I just really couldn't reconcile the work that I was doing for hire, basically. And my sort of collaborative stuff with Mike, which was limited.
Was the character design and stuff that you'd done? Or?
No, I mean, Mike came up with the plots. I did a lot of the dialogue and the storytelling, but it was kind of my role doing that made an easy transition to animation, because somebody else would provide the basic structure and then I would deal with the mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Fill everything in.
Yeah, and so it was really, the character designs were mine for Zombie World. I did a little bit of character design later when I went into animation, but it was basically, you're interpreting a script.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in my mind, I've often seen it more as a something in motion, which, you know, naturally led to things like the Strip and Weasel and things like that. So I've been sort of all over the place, hither and thither, because I have a broad range of interests, none of which were really easy to contain, basically, within comic books.
Mm-hmm.
So it might just have been a question of bigger boxes, but it was really hard to jam everything I wanted to do into little boxes. And also the constraints of the business, if you want to make money at it, you're up against market expectations and deadlines, production deadlines. So in a weird way, it was easier to almost divest myself of personal involvement and just do the mechanical stuff for animation.
Do you think it helped you evolve as an artist, doing all that storyboarding?
I was doing that when I went back to finish my BFA in earnest. So I had two lives, one which was academic and studio art based, where I was basically just doing abstraction for the first couple of years, and photography. So my paintings were all abstract, hard to kind of describe or put it into context. It would be post-painterly abstraction was a big influence, so I don't know if that means anything to your audience. I'm sure some of them are in fine arts, so they'll know who people like Ad Reinhardt are, and Kenneth Nolan, people like that. And then narrative and figuration started to creep back into it by the end of my BFA. But I kept that separate in photography, basically. I did a bunch of narrative photography where I set up fairly elaborate tableau.
Did you, like, are your fans ever going to see this stuff, or is it just all for school and that's the end of that?
That stuff was mostly academic exercises, and okay. it's a learning process, and you sort of exhibit it because that's part of the education. You have to learn how to exhibit artwork, and you have to learn how to, you know, take feedback. But it was a good way to bridge the gap between comics, which is an art that is bound by the conventions of reproducing it, and something which is more experiential in an immediate sense. So it's not mediated by mechanical reproduction at all, so it's really engaged with materials and the physical presence of a singular work.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, there are a lot of things that are very particular to comics that are all about printing it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the aesthetics of comics kind of comes about from the technology that was used way, way back. And even though we have digital technology and you can have any kind of halftone or you can basically reproduce any kind of artwork now, the aesthetics of comics are still so informed by the early years of it.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the clear line style and various types of rendering and
that
stuff like that.
The history of North American comics has always been guilty of that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's juvenile literature.
Yeah. Well, you're just limited by the technology and, again, the expediences of the marketplace when you're working in that. And that was, the independent comics guys were great because they were much more experimental, even within the constraints of those limitations, and
mm-hmm.
they would just push it to the edges. And I mean, Chris Ware, he was the tipping point in terms of formal experimentation, and obviously that had been set up by Raw and Art Spiegelman and that whole group of people. And that was what led to the Weasel Strip in a lot of ways for me, because I really wanted to play around with the mechanics of the medium.
That's exactly what that strip is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think only Alan Moore has done anything like that I've seen, where you can read it in so many different ways, backwards, forwards, sideways, back, all around.
Yeah.
And it'll tell a different story every time, but it all still seems to blend into each other and make sense. Like, it's pretty genius.
Thanks. Well, I'll take that. It's definitely probably one of the five best things that I ever did. So,
do you think you blew your wad too early? Because you didn't do anything after that.
No, I just...
You were supposed to be contributing to every Weasel, weren't you?
Well, that was... Dave, that's still a bone of contention because I didn't really understand it as being an ongoing thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'd agreed to that in a provisional way because I didn't really know... I think Dave felt he'd explained it to me thoroughly, and I never really quite understood.
Grasped it.
Yeah, and I was committed to other things at the time. I was storyboarding. The storyboarding thing was happening. I was also freelancing for Vertigo at that point.
Yeah, because you did like Heartthrobs and Flinch and Strange Adventures for them.
And that was all done while I was at school as well.
Yeah.
So just before, just around the time I started storyboarding Batman Beyond. So there was a lot going on. I was also doing Luna Park at that time. It was all in about a one-year period. I had all this small stuff going on. And that's probably the time when I really left comics. But that was some of the best work that I'd done.
Can you talk to us about Luna Park? You did that for Disney?
I was trying to develop something. And this was... Heidi McDonald generously gave me the space in the magazine. But she was at the end of her tenure there, unbeknownst to both of us. And I was having a hard time, again, with her, much like with Dave, being committal about it, because I had the storyboarding thing and school, and the people in the industry weren't really that sympathetic to my academic pursuits. They weren't against it, but they were for it only in so far as it didn't interrupt what I was doing. So, and I wasn't totally clear about my goals and where my priorities were. It was a strange time in my life. I'd just come back from New York after the end of this 7-year relationship that I mentioned. So trying to sort of restart my life and wanting to take it in a different direction. So hence the animation and the school. And in this sort of little bubble, you know, the thing for Weasel and the stuff for Luna Park and for the Vertigo anthologies all came out. And
did you write
the hormones thing for Bob Fingerman's minimum wage. So.
Now, you wrote the minimum wage, the backup in the minimum wage book. Did you also write the Luna Park stuff?
Yeah.
What's Luna Park about? Because that's for kids. I mean, pretty much most of what you've done is kind of for adults.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, I'd been working for Disney Adventures for years, and I was doing some stuff for OWL, which strangely came out of the stuff I'd done for Bice magazine.
That is strange.
Yeah, the art director at OWL at the time had been looking around, and he'd been paying attention to who was in Bice, and there are a lot of people in Bice who had done children's properties, or have since gone on to do children's properties. I speak about it as properties, but that's sort of how it was. You know, I was trying to make something of my own.
So what was the gist of the story? Were they comic strips? Was there boy-girl, girl-girl, boy-boy?
Yeah,
was it like Sugar and Smacky?
No, no, it's definitely not that. But I mean, it would have probably been more appropriate for OWL or even Nickelodeon, but Disney was the outlet that I had. It's kind of...
Why? Because would you say Disney was more censorious, or like, why would you say it's more appropriate for the other magazines?
Just because Disney was more uniform in the kind of material they were generating. It was mostly about their own material, and it was just a short period of experimentation. They had a few other things going on. I didn't really follow it. It was really all about Heidi. Heidi McDonald and her trying to create space for independent cartoonists within that magazine.
Yeah.
You know, and it was kind of gothic, I guess, but not in the late 90s style of gothic. It was a little bit more Edward Gorey influenced, but also people like Everett Peck and who developed Duckman, but kind of that big head, little body cartoon style. A lot more rendering. It was more atmospheric. It was pretty whimsical, but still a little bit slapstick. It was meant to be ongoing with this core cast of characters. There were five of them. The boy girl, the main boy girl, Luna, and Hugo. Hugo and his dog, Ball. His best friend, August, and another girl who I think her name was Naomi. She only appeared in the second strip very briefly. But there were only two strips before I just kind of let it slide, because Heidi was going to leave, and she was going to pass it on to her successor, and I was already having trouble. They wanted it to be in every issue, which was the only way it was probably going to build an audience, and I just didn't have time, and I didn't have a whole wealth of ideas in the back of my mind, and I didn't have time to sort of sit down and generate a bunch of springboard ideas, so it just kind of languished, and my other commitments took over. And it's still there. I was approached by an Australian kids magazine at one point. And again, I pitched it to OWL magazine again more recently, an updated version of it. They took a pass on it, but they were intrigued. So it may have a future somewhere. And the graphic novel for Gallimard has a lot of similar themes and dynamics and atmosphere. So it's still around.
I just wanted to go over some of the miscellaneous stuff you've done. I'm assuming the Hellboy Jr. stuff came out of working with Mike on Zombie World. Did you enjoy working on Hellboy? You just mentioned that you saw that really early sketch that he'd done.
Well, the Hellboy Jr. thing was really Bill Ray's brainchild. And
I really like that series, but there's a lot of Hellboy fans that really don't like it at all. I just think it's really charming.
Yeah. Well, it was Bill's, you know, playfully irreverent all the time. And I mean, he'd been working for Mad Magazine, and he'd done a bunch.
He did the best issue of Dexter's Lab.
Yeah. He's, you know, he understands that American 50s to 70s style, the limited animation thing, and he's a cartoon genius who never really got his due. He did a short pilot for Cartoon Network around that time that just got totally overlooked.
But was it Big Blown Baby? Or?
No, I can't even remember what it was called. It was a sci-fi thing. But Bill was a Ren and Stimpy alumni along with Steve DiStefano. So those were the guys. And because I was working in animation at the time, we kind of came into closer contact. But yeah, no, that was Bill's baby. And Mike let him pretty much run with it. And Bill's a champion of lowbrow humor, and he's unapologetic about it. So I thought it was good. I didn't think my piece was that good. I thought it was too uptight, and I wasn't super happy, I hate to say it, with the colors Bill did, because he's a color genius, and it felt really flat-footed. to me, so that was a little unfortunate, but he was kind of right in saying that the work that I did on it was just too stiff, and I agree. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, it's a pretty wacky comic,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so. Definitely. So, not one of my favorite things that I did, but I thought everybody else's contributions were fine. I thought it was a fun anthology. I really love Big Retarded Duck, so, yeah. Which is the one that doesn't get reprinted in the foreign editions.
Why?
I don't know. They have
That's
a hard time
weird.
With it. Yeah.
I guess the humor doesn't translate.
I think they're all pretty politically incorrect, so.
You also did Metalman with Bob Fingerman for yep. Bizarro Comics.
Yeah, again, that was doing animation and at school, and Bob just kind of threw this thing my way, and oh my god, I just said the editor's name a little while ago, and now it escapes
Joe Cavallari?
Yeah, Joey Cavallari. He let me, you know, work on it in little dribs and drabs over about like a 7-month period.
Wow.
So, because there weren't fixed deadlines on the book that I knew of.
Yeah. Well, you know how that came about, right?
Vaguely.
It was like Kyle Baker did a comic about Superman's babysitter putting him in the microwave, and it got completely... They published it, but then yeah. Levitt censored it and recalled all the issues back. And
crazy.
Then I guess he just... I don't know, maybe Kyle Baker. I don't know who pitched it, but
yeah.
somebody pitched the idea of just putting it in a collection of all this other alternative creators' take on superheroes. And, you know, Dave Cooper's is awesome.
Yeah.
I love his pieces in those. And your art was really well-suited for Metal Man. It was a really funny, goofy sort of irreverent
yeah.
take on it.
It was funny because I think Joey offered it to me, like, you can do anything you want with it. And I think he expected me to do something more, like, in a style more... like I'd done with the Hormone story and Minimum Wage or the Weasel thing that I did, well, No Escape that I did for Weasel, but I felt compelled to do it a little closer to a mainstream style. I still did my own take on that, and it was still pretty informed by a lot of other stuff. Again.
Well, it's still pretty sexy, you know,
yeah.
that's what cracks me up about
well,
it.
Well, it's the Metal Men, you
yeah.
know, and it was Bob's script, too, where they were all... you know, in a nightclub, and it's the nightclub scene. It's the same nightclub from the Kissing Cousins story that Bob and I did for, for which anthology?
It was Heartthrobs.
Heartthrobs. So, you know, it was just there. I mean, it was a great script, and Bob and all those guys who were doing that stuff were using that as a way to finance their own independent stuff, because it's just too hard to make a living
yeah.
Working for Fantagraphics. I mean, they paid what they can, but you...
When they can.
Yeah, exactly. but, you know, it was happily, you know, people like Joey Cavallari were willing to... you know, take a gamble on stuff like that. And the climate was there at the time. Again, people were grasping.
Mm-hmm. I love those books. I think they're amazing because it's just so many of my favorite creators are taking this totally bizarro approach
yeah.
to the characters. It's excellent.
Well, if the guys who had done Cooper Skeeber hadn't done it, I don't know if anyone would have thought to do it.
Yeah.
But I think the initiative they took on that really showed
mm-hmm.
the mainstream guys that, oh, you know, there's a lot of territory to be mined
yeah,
here.
Yeah, exactly.
That we haven't, it's gone unexamined, and it's, you know, and that's the stuff.
And there's definitely an audience for it.
Totally, and that's the stuff that, you know, went on to be, you know, graphic novel material in the bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
More, I think it got more... oh, play? I don't know. Legitimacy? It was more art, and not just artistic. So, yeah.
The last thing I saw you do was Dark Horse's Book of the Dead.
Yeah.
And recently, Bernie told me that Johann Safard asked you to do a comic for him. And when I see that Book of the Dead, is he an influence on you? Because a lot of... I don't know if it's the inking style of that story, or... It's still Pat McEwan, but it's so cross-hatchy and wobbly like Safar's work, you know?
Yeah, well, it was something... It was, you know, it happened over the course of my undergraduate degree, too. And I've always drawn like that, but it's always just stayed in my sketchbooks. Because
mm-hmm.
I could never find somebody who would publish that. I came really close around the time I did Hormones for Bob Fingerman, and I was shopping some stuff around to DC, and I'd had a meeting with their art director at the time. His name escapes me. He used to color Mike Mignola's work. Anyways. And he'd sort of expressed a mild interest, but, you know, hadn't committed to anything, and I was doing stuff for Guff and Dark Horse and
for
Scatterbrain as well.
Yeah,
so
I've got both of those too.
So nobody really bit, and it just kind of, again, languished while I was at school doing other stuff and working on storyboards. And after I graduated, I was scrambling around for things to do, and I called Scott to see about maybe doing something with Zombie World. And he offered me, you know, some pages in one of the anthologies, so I worked up an outline based on some sketches I'd done and some rough ideas. And I took a character that I'd used in my Wanted Man story from Dark Horse Presents, which was another kind of high watermark for me in terms of craft and the beginnings of some of the formal experimentation that came to fruition with No Escape. I took one of those characters, made it a little more G-rated, and put together a nice little story that I felt pretty happy with.
Yeah, it's a beautiful piece.
And again, it was a little bit experimental in terms of the structure of the story. Scott wasn't totally happy with the ending, and it's a little bit condensed. It would have been good to stretch it out to another page or two. But it ended in more or less the fashion that I wanted it to. But Dave Cooper sent JPEGs of that to Johan Svarr, whose work I was aware of at that point. I'd spent some time in France, and I'd come across his work in North America, but I found a bunch of it in France, and I'd become a fan, but I hadn't really pursued it. So when Dave sent my work off to him and Louis Trondheim, they got back to me almost immediately and approached me about maybe doing something for their Dungeon series.
Yeah, I love that series so much.
It's really good, and they've worked with a lot of really interesting people, but they didn't have anything for me right away. At that point, Johan was just about to be, or Johan, I'm not actually even sure how his name is pronounced.
Me either.
I've never talked to him in person, so we've only exchanged emails, but he was just about to be headhunted by Gallimard, which is, you know, one of France's oldest and most venerated publishers, so that was kind of exciting. So he was sort of saying, you know, hang on, I may have a project that's, you know, perfect for you. And at this point, I was in Montreal and I'd begun grad school, and he offered me this 122-page graphic novel. He's like, you want to write and draw one? Just, you know, send us a 10-page proposal. Mm-hmm. An outline and then 10 pages of original artwork. So I did that during my summer semester, and while I was working on other stuff. And they liked it, and they were willing to wait until I'd finished my coursework.
Nice.
And then while I was juggling my thesis exhibition, I basically took a year to teach introductory drawing at Concordia and write and draw my graphic novel, which is a story that had been, I guess, simmering on the back burner for a while. I had chapters written, partially, and these characters somewhat developed. They'd appeared briefly in a sketchbook section of Sturgeon White Moss.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because when I was doing research online, it mentioned that you were in number 4.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the most latest thing that you've done?
That, up to that point, it was, prior to the graphic novel, and prior, actually, to the Book of the Dead. That was the last thing I'd done, and those characters were there in a sketchbook page in a rough form, pretty much the form they take in the graphic novel.
So what's the name of the graphic novel?
It's not been decided yet, so okay. It depends on how it'll translate into French. The working title that I have at the moment is The Hair Shirt, but it remains to be seen. So I'm still hoping that when it gets licensed in North America, that'll be the North American title. It may have a different title in French. So.
And what's the premise?
It's a dark little story. It's semi-autobiographical. It's entirely, you know, real-life stuff. There's some sort of surreal elements to it, but it's not like magical realism. They're more metaphorical. They're probably dreams, but it's never really articulated. It's kind of a failed romance and a ghost story. So, it's a little on the melodramatic side, a little more so than I would like it to be, but that's basically what Gallimard wanted.
Is it because they're trying to cater to a specific audience? And
they've not been really explicit about it, but the implication is that it's geared for an adolescent audience. So people who haven't necessarily read a lot of comics So they want a more or less conventional, conventionally structured narrative,
yeah.
And something that's... They were kind of describing it, Yoann was describing what he had in mind as like a comic book version of an independent film.
Okay.
So it's like that. It's, you know, if I had my druthers, I'd probably change a few things, but it's good to just get the story out and not complicate it.
When's it coming out?
Scheduled for September release in Europe,
mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure when it'll be translated back. It'll be issued in North America. They still have to decide on a publisher right now. And if it were up to me, Drawn and Quarterly's done one or two of the books in the same line.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love for them to take it over, but I'm not sure if it's something they'll want because it's not.
Their
it's a little
regular
bit,
audience.
Yeah, it's a little bit more conventional than their standard fare. So at least formally anyways, I think in terms of narrative it might be appropriate. It's hard to say. First Second is the other publisher they're dealing with here, so.
Yeah, I love First Second. They're really good.
Yeah, I don't really know aside
they're
from...
They're new, too. They've only been out for like the past 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I guess it's just some of the stuff they publish I'm not crazy about, but they've done Yoann Safar stuff.
So. Yeah, I really like the Yoann Safar stuff, and there was Dio Gratia, so that was excellent.
Okay.
And they've done a bunch of Eddie Campbell's work.
Okay, well that's good to know. I haven't really done a lot of research on it, so
I think, you know, for a really young publisher, that right out of the gate they were publishing some excellent books,
mm-hmm.
and they've been really modest in what they've been doing. They haven't, like, you know, blown the hog really fast,
yeah.
And so there's going to be a longevity with these comics, which is excellent.
Well, yeah, keeping them in print will be good, and I do have some other stories outlined, and if Gallimard is interested, they have first refusal on my next two works. There may be more, I'm not sure, I have other sort of irons and other fires at this point.
One of the things I did want to talk about is the latest thing I saw by you was that art show that you did at Concordia,
mm-hmm.
and it's not remotely comic book oriented, but I really enjoyed it because when I saw it, it kind of reminded me of spending winters at my grandmother's in Southern Ontario. You know, where it's like the Barrens of Ontario,
where you just
walk for 10 minutes and suddenly you're in the middle of nowhere surrounded by trees and, you know, grass or snow or what have you, and these abandoned, ratty old houses. And
well, yeah, I guess to describe it for the audience, it was an installation that I did with some large-scale drawings and then some sculpture. One was a 20-foot hairy sweater thing.
Yeah.
And then,
but you didn't make the sweater, somebody else did.
Yeah, that's true. I did knit a little bit of the sweater, but it was knit by Andrea
Van der Kolk. Was it part of your exhibit? Did you say, I want you to make this?
Yeah,
I
more or less commissioned it,
okay.
And then gave her specifications, and she went to town with it. She's an artist in her own right, and a fibers artist, incredibly skilled. So, yeah, we collaborated on that part of it, but she knew that it was going to be this particular kind of object. And
can you explain the theme of your piece?
It was really about narrative, and it was about this kind of psychological landscape and kind of projecting it into this space. So it's really, it's not that different from comics in that it's still really about telling stories. And it's still drawing-oriented, but it's just in bigger boxes. And, you know, approaching a long tunnel-like room and dividing it into three sections. So you can think of those as panels, if you want. And it, you know, creates this sequential narrative of three spaces that all sort of feed back into each other. So you're kind of guided through by this sweater. It kind of leads you from one room to the other. And in each room, there's a different sort of visual event. In the middle room, there's these two large-scale drawings, which are sort of a surreal, dreamlike narrative. These tumble-down shacks and forests, but these interior spaces, kind of cellar-like, or, you know, it's all sort of dark and dreamy, but it wasn't meant to be necessarily sinister so much as just
well, the things
twilight
you mentioned
sort of
before
space.
is unspoken and repressed.
Yeah,
and that's how I felt when I was looking at them, you know? Like,
yeah, well, I took inspiration from my sister's property, which is in Elmont, 40 minutes outside of Ottawa, and she has 40 acres. It's an old farm that she bought. So those tumble-down shacks are there, and a lot of the objects in them were there before she got there, but it's got a lot to do, not specifically with my sister, but a kind of cultural memory in how I think of growing up in Ontario and things like that, things that precede me, but things that are important to me.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's just a feeling. Yeah. I totally know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really felt that when I was looking at it.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, I'm glad to know. That's been the general response, and I think for some of my peers in the MFA program, it may have seemed a little flat-footed or literal, because it's pretty straight up in how it represents stuff. I'm not trying to tiptoe around it. Yeah, and there's dark undercurrents, but again, I don't think of them so much as sinister. They're more ambiguous, because mm-hmm. I pick the motifs that I pick because they kind of register both ways.
Yeah, well, exactly. They have the potential to become dark, but they're not necessarily dark.
No, and I wanted people to consider conventional interpretations of dark, because I really was thinking of it as more of a quiet, dreamlike space. Mm-hmm. Somewhere, I think in my thesis statement, I talked about the idea of interval a lot. It was an in-between space, and expanding the sort of in-between space, which comics have the potential to be, but they've been sort of directed in different ways. And in the case of the installation, it's a question of scale. You can't jam something like that into a page.
No.
I mean, I really
love the grandness of it, though. Like, it really spoke volumes being that large.
Well, you're supposed to be sort of immersed in it, and immersive environments have been popular for a while in art practice, and they're also kind of passé now. And there's a lot of discussion around the idea of public spectacle and how pervasive it is and things like that. But I don't know that has much bearing on you know, comics or anything like that. But it's an area that I'm interested in exploring. I don't know if I'm going to really actively pursue a professional career in installation. The graphic novel does inform the installation. There's a lot of they sort of played off each other, but they're very different things, so, and I wanted to kind of keep them different, but I still see them part of my overall body of work. Thematically, they're really linked, but it's kind of like everything that's not in the installation is there in the graphic novel, so. But
yeah, because I was going to ask you, you know, you were talking about photography, and I was just wondering if you were going to be considering doing mixed media art pieces, because that's another thing that I loved about it, is that you have this giant knit thing in the middle of it you can kind of touch and walk through and be a part of if you choose.
Yeah, well, it's a non-linear narrative, and we see a lot of that in comic books, but it's not something that's, you know, really popular supported very well. I mean, people have...
Yeah, I remember Rich Tomasso did that roller coaster book. Did you ever see that?
No.
Where it was a total non-linear thing, and people, I remember people getting so upset.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Fort Thunder guys kind of picked up those threads after Art Spiegelman left off. But again, it's still really invested in the language of comics, and you know, guys like Brian Chippendale and Chippendale in particular, I think he's kind of carried on the Gary Panter thing quite a bit, and the guy who did Teratoid Heights, those two guys were, I think, it took some chances.
Mark Bell, I'd find, too, is kind of non-linear in his writing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Mark has definitely crossed those boundaries between those worlds much earlier than I did. He's still really invested in paper and the language of comics, even more than I am, and also in specific tropes that come out of the comic strips, the newspaper comic strips, and independent comics. My stuff tends to be more romantic, more lyrical, and that's something that I've kind of struggled with, because it's seen as artsy but not art. I think the people in the art world are a little bit more open. When I was talking about artsy versus art, that had more to do with the perceptions of comic book people.
Oh, okay.
So the stuff that they tend to have in the past anyways accepted as more artful, and this is again laid down by Spiegelman's stuff that's a little bit more angular, a little bit more invested specifically in the North American language of comics, as you know, the precedents were set in the comic strips of the early 10s and 20s, and so that was the vocabulary they were working with almost exclusively, or seen as legitimate, whereas this stuff, mine kind of came out of more illustrative tradition.
Do you think it's because you're Canadian?
I think that's part of it, for sure. I'm not as invested in that sense of orthodoxy that even Canadians like Seth and Chester Brown are, like, mm-hmm. they're very particular about the eras or the era that they choose to exploit. And it's all directly linked to magazine illustration or early comic strips. So it's been interesting to see Chester's trajectory from somebody who had pretty broad influences to basically aping Harold Gray. And he's also adopted Harold's politics, which are pretty conservative, and I find that kind of, I don't know, mind-boggling, personally.
Well, from what I understand, his next book is going to be about...
prostitutes.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, he's become a born-again...
ladies of the night.
Yeah. He's become a born-again libertarian through his association with Dave Sim,
yes.
And I find it a little dubious, quite frankly. I just think, whatever. I have no problem with him doing a story about
prostitutes at all.
But I don't think you need to be a libertarian to do that. So
I don't know. Like when I was reading the dialogue between the two of them, it didn't necessarily sound like Dave Sim was brainwashing Chester. It seemed Chester definitely had his own opinions.
No, and Chester's always, you know, been pretty, an independent thinker. I'm just, I haven't spoken to him about it personally. I've heard him speak about it on the radio and through other people, but the interview on the radio that I heard, it seemed it was fairly ill-informed and shaped by, exposure within a pretty limited group of people. And mm-hmm. it seemed more like a reactive thing than a really well-considered position that he was taking. Mm-hmm. He just sort of seemed to be reacting to how people had embraced or not embraced his, what he thought were his liberal ideas. So
you mentioned that you designed some Vice toys?
Well, yeah, I guess technically Gavin came up with the initial designs. He just needed me to interpret them for the sculptor. Mm-hmm. So, I added my own flourishes, and if I'd stuck closer to Gavin's designs, I think they might have made more interesting toys, but I got the impression that he wanted me to make them a little bit more realistic.
What toys are these? Are these the do's and don'ts toys?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Which I thought the sculptor did a good job based on my designs, but I feel like the designs could have been more interesting. But it's the nature of how Gavin does business. It happened last minute. They didn't really pay me adequately for my time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, again, I was in grad school, and I basically did it on my Christmas vacation. So I did turnarounds for these four figures in full color, and Gavin's a fairly particular man. He's got very specific ideas about what is and what isn't fashionable and the edge of ambiguity that he can play with, and so I worked pretty closely with him for about 2 weeks, and then they just kind of came out, and I felt like he didn't really care about them. They were just sort of a promotional
merchandising
item
thing,
something to extend the
Vice empire.
Yeah, exactly, the franchise again. So and then once that was done with, I did another illustration for them, the Vice Guide to You,
mm-hmm.
which was basically almost a caricature of Gavin again, but it was your typical sort of Williamsburg hipster at that point. So, that's the last sort of dealings I've had with those guys for a while. So.
One of my last couple of questions was, can you explain Gary Panter to me?
Explain him to
me? Like, I just, I have another friend who's a really big fan of his work too, and it's just one of those things, like, I love comics and I'm really into comics, but I have a really hard time with Gary Panter's
book.
Oh, yeah? Yeah. Well, I know I'm in the minority. I'm right or wrong.
No,
I
don't really know how to explain.
Is it because it's so punk rock with a R-A-W-K?
No, he was there at the beginning of the LA scene, and it was...
And obviously I appreciate the stuff he's done for Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yeah, no, it was more the exploding of the form. Like, he really quite literally exploded it. It was so excessive and yet so minimal at the same time. That guy is strangely ignored, aside from his work for Pee-wee's Playhouse throughout the late 80s, and then thanks to people like the Fort Thunder guys, who saw him as a bridge between comics and probably what they were doing at art school.
Because
he was definitely a product of art school. I think he was...
Well, wasn't he involved with Raw?
He was, yeah, in the early stages. He was also involved in the early stages of Slash Magazine, Slash Records, the early LA punk rock label. But he went to art school in Texas in the 70s, and there were a bunch of other underground comics people who were there at the time, like from the previous generation, I think, and some other of his contemporaries, maybe George Ann Dean. I'm not sure, a few people like that. But he also knows Matt Groening.
Okay, yeah.
And they did some stuff early on. So he was kind of part of that punk new wave explosion, but I don't really align him with, like, the later punk rock thing. Really just the early stages when it was about breaking with convention and before it became fine-tuned into the lovely commodity that it is today, really easily defined. Gary was, and he still does, he's really just...
on the fringes.
He likes to experiment. His comics have become a little bit more fine-tuned and a little bit more conventional in some ways, but still, he plays around with structure. He does. He has a whole career as, you know, doing light shows and stuff like that. I got to meet him a couple of years ago through Dave Cooper. He came to the Ottawa Animation
Festival. What do you mean light shows? Because another person you mentioned is that you like is Sherry Boyle, and she does a lot of really great light shows, too.
Well, Sherry's stuff is incredible, but it's... From what I know of Gary's stuff, his is much more like psychedelic light shows from the 60s.
Okay.
But I'm not sure how far he's taking it because I haven't seen them in person.
Okay.
But I feel like they're a real sensory assault.
Yeah.
That's the impression that I get. Like, you know, the kind of thing that you would just be in awe of.
Mm-hmm.
Sherry's stuff is much more narrative, and she plays around with, what you can do with reflection and projection in really ingenious ways.
Yeah.
So it's quite the thing to witness.
Yeah, and I adore her work.
Yeah.
I got to meet her at Banff, like we were all speaking.
Oh, crazy.
And I really admire her a lot. She's an amazing artist.
Yeah, she's been a real, I'd say, you know, with somebody like Gary, she's another kind of person who bridges the gap, and she's not really that invested with comic books.
No, not at all. It's Sammy Harkham that got her involved. Like,
she's
mostly just into the actual just painting. And,
But
even Witness My Shame has a lot of comic book elements to it, and that was like her first collection of art, you know, of her little zines.
Well, I think that was one of the great things about a lot of the women who became involved with comics is that they weren't invested in specific styles or artists or histories of comics, but they were generally familiar with it. So they just kind of took whatever seemed intuitively appropriate.
Who are some of the female cartoonists you're reading today?
I don't really read comics, so I just see stuff.
Okay.
And I can't remember names.
Okay, don't worry about
it. But, you know, everybody is working, and there's a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people like Jillian Tamaki are fun.
Mm-hmm.
She's the person who gets a lot of press, so that's a name that sort of stuck in my mind. But I'll go through the Drawn and Quarterly store and just browse.
I can't go in there. I really can't because I'm just like, so much stuff in here
I
want.
Well, it's great. And I mean, it's great to see how diverse the landscape is.
Yeah, they don't just carry their own stuff. It's really nice.
But just the medium as a whole.
Yeah.
And they represent it pretty well from what I can tell. And just the way people have embraced or not embraced particular traditions or eschewed them in favor of others. And there's a lot of, I see much more influence from various types of illustration, and you can see that a lot of these kids are in art school because of the kind of stuff they're bringing to the comics. And I think of people like Julie Morstad. She had a little book through Drawn and Quarterly, Milk Teeth.
Yeah, she really...
Which I have.
She made me think of your hair shirt, because she's got like a couple of like the characters that are all covered in the hair.
Well, somebody was teasing me about the proliferation of hair in comics and art school in general, and it seems to be
even Jamie Hewlett has one.
Oh, yeah. Well, it seems to be a pretty apt trope for the moment. I'm not sure. Wood grain and hair seem to lend themselves well to the idea of drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And two other kind of subconscious things, but you know, it's a pretty organic thing. So, but her in particular, when I look at her work, I see, you know, people like the Royal Art Lodge.
Yeah, Marcel DeZama.
Yeah, and I see Amy Cutler, a bunch of people from the art world, and then I also see Edward Gorey and all this 19th century stuff. Maybe Dame Darcy.
Yeah.
People like that. So there's much more. Dialogue between those
worlds.
Well,
it's probably, I'd have to say, it's probably because of the advent of the internet. I mean, information and imagery is so accessible now, so you can be influenced by anything.
Yeah, I don't think you can underestimate the influence of the internet at all. So, but again, I mean, a lot of these kids, like Julie Morstad's an ACAD grad, so yeah, there's a lot art school.
Emily Carr.
Is it Emily Carr?
Isn't that ACAD?
Oh, no, that's ACAD. She's from the Alberta College of Art and Design. So,
I'm like, wait a minute. Well, just because not everyone knows the acronyms, right?
Right. Well, a lot of the kids who go to art school, well, and I'm sure you got a lot of listeners from Concordia.
Yeah.
I may have even taught one or two of them. But, yeah, so I think that's definitely played a role. There's not so much opposition to that stuff anymore. Like, when I talk to people like Chester and Joe, they're just... Joe went to art school too, but it was much more being geared towards illustration.
Well, yeah, in the old days, cartooning was for kids and real art.
It was about the trade and it was about entertainment, and the whole field is more experimental now. It's still limited to what you can do on a printed page, but there's quite a lot you can do on a printed page.
One of the guys I really like is Jordan Crane. Have you seen his work? Like, I find that he does some really interesting and innovative stuff with his books and...
Yeah, he feels like if he's not out of Fort Thunder directly, he's got some affiliation.
He's affiliated,
with Brian Ralph and
for
and
sure,
those
Ron
guys.
Ritchie.
Yeah, so he's one of what Gary Panter called the gentleman cartoonist.
Totally, it's so clean and pretty, like.
Well, it's very gentle and it's very lyrical, and it was one of the things that I had a hard time with when I would have discussions with Joe and Seth. And is there appeal to legitimacy in this sort of urbane, reserved character of their work, even though Joe takes on some really difficult subjects and he's pretty lowbrow about some of it, but it is really gentle. And I was
Seth is the epitome of that.
Yeah, and I have an immense amount of respect for Seth's work, and I think he's really good.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of tired of it though.
Well, that's okay. I speak as somebody who hasn't read anything since his early graphic novel.
I love It's a Good Life If You Don't Weekend, and I really, and he's totally mortified by it, but I really enjoyed those first two issues of Palookaville because it was like, actually different from what he's doing now. And I understand that, he's kind of doing a Jason Lutz where he's, trying to work with pacing and timing.
Yeah.
It's just that, finding it really dull, and then it's also getting to the point now where, like, I went to the Art Gallery of Ontario, he's the only cartoonist in there, and it's okay, Canada has spawned other cartoonists besides Seth.
Sure.
Are we just picking Seth because he's socially acceptable with his art style? Like, the old lady in Alberta is going to like it, whereas Chester, she might not be so into it.
Well, I think there's something to be said for Seth in terms of his visibility and the fact that he's staked out a very specific area for himself and worked it really hard. And he's become known for it. And yeah, it is more acceptable, and that's just sort of the way it works. You run something up the flagpole and see how people respond, and then that tends to mediate your work. So you tend to go with the things that you perceive are working or being well responded to, unless you have a real agenda about, I'm going to do this and I don't care what people think. So, but I think Seth strikes a nice balance, but it's a thing that I could never do or never do for very long. I couldn't live there. I could visit it stylistically, but he's really invested in it.
Well, it's a very strict regimen of an art style. Like, it hasn't evolved in, like, 10 years.
No, and I mean, that's, I think, how it gets. There's not too many people who have more than one or two great ideas. And, but, I don't begrudge him his success at all. It just, when I was kind of trying to find my own voice, I think that those three guys, Chester, Seth, and Joe, loomed so large in the landscape that it was hard to find my own thing. And then Chris Ware and Dan Close, and again all the other people that I named. And there was a sense that things had chosen a path and people had sort of invested a lot in these guys as the thing that would carry the medium to legitimacy in terms of bookstores. And people were talking about bookstores.
Well, it did happen. Yeah. I mean, look at It's a Good Life If You Don't Weekend and Lurie. They're both highly popular books in bookstores.
Yeah, well, and they do operate on more of a literary model. Like, there's not the same kind of formal experimentation that Raw had or that the Fort Thunder work has, which is, I think, comes from more of a fine arts approach. You're really, trying to explode the form or smash things together and see what might happen. Chris Ware is one of those guys who's right in between, because it's literary, but it's very formally experimental. The only problem is that he's kind of
Well, he's made it really pretty.
Well, and he's found his thing and just kind of stuck with that. So it's really about subdividing things and playing around with time and pacing. But the stories that he tells are fairly complex, but
yeah,
they're starting to seem really similar.
Yeah. Oh, well, I don't know. Yeah. Like, I can see your point, and they have been feeling similar since the beginning. Like, you know, he's got this weird sort of darkness that I really, really hated.
Oh, yeah.
But I think he's mellowed out because I'm finding the stories are more accessible now. And that last issue, 19, I loved it. The issue 18 blew my mind. I mean, as someone who moves a lot, I was just kind of like, wow, I can really relate to this, you know?
Oh, yeah. I think in terms of how they, you know, treat their characters and in terms of that kind of stuff. And believe me, I would love to have a body of work like Chris Ware's, you know. Really impressed with everything he's done.
And honestly, in like the last year and a half, I haven't really been buying comics, but I have bought every issue of Acme Novelty Library.
That's good. I mean, I think both he and Dan Close have kind of come into their own as writers as well as cartoonists.
Yeah, for sure.
I didn't really ever finish David Boring, but
I didn't like that one so much, but the one that was right after David Boring, the Haven, I believe it was called, that one issue, was genius. Pure genius. Like, it was just... I think it just seems like, you know, they go through this time period and then all of a sudden everything they've been working towards culminates into this piece of art that is just above and beyond anything they've done.
Well, I feel like with those guys, I have no fear that they're going to accomplish what they set out to do. And, you know, with Dan Close, it's like 20 years of reading that guy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not... I don't think I'm going to see anything really surprising from him that I haven't seen before, but I think I'm going to see it assembled and refined.
Yeah, well, he's become better and tighter. I mean, you can really see the youth in his writing when you start reading those early A-Balls.
Yeah. I think the only danger at that point is that once they get to the point where they've kind of honed their craft so much, there's...
They stagnate.
Well, it's not even stagnation. There's just less to separate them from other novelists who just work strictly in text.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're in a whole other landscape of people who have, you know, it's almost to the point where Dan Close and Chris Ware, not Chris Ware so much, but the drawing has become almost invisible.
Yeah, it's second to the writing.
Because it works so well and you're so used to seeing it that it almost doesn't jump out at you as much.
That's a good point.
So I feel like... with those guys, to some degree, the drawing is subordinate to the writing in a way that I've never felt entirely comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a bit of a challenge to do the graphic novel because, again, the drawing really has to serve the story.
Has your art evolved for this new graphic novel, or is it the same style as the Book of the Dead? Or?
Yeah, it's pretty much like the Book of the Dead. It's a little bit more refined. There's a lot more rendering, and yeah, it's. It's growing, it's always growing, always changing. I think I'll probably do it differently the next time because it's really hard to color.
Well, you said that Bernie's going to be coloring this book?
Yeah, it's just with all that kind of hatching and rendering, it's really hard to select areas if you're coloring it on the computer. Excuse me.
Was it hard changing over to computer? Because you were drawing in the 80s, so...
Oh, no. I mean, it was slow. I didn't have to learn it all at once because I wasn't doing a lot of color work, so I kind of picked it up over the years. Dave Cooper helped me a lot with shortcuts, and I've kind of developed my own systems for things.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie's helping me. I mean, I learn stuff all the time. You know, we're at Photoshop CS3 now, and I don't think I've even exhausted all the possibilities of Photoshop 4, you know, so... You know, but it's, you know, it's good, it's fun, it presents a lot of possibilities, and there's lots of opportunities for experimentation that I'd like to follow up on, but I don't really see how I can just squeeze them into a story, so it may require another outlet for it, so.
You're still working on storyboards still?
Yeah, I'm working on the Venture Brothers right now with Steve DiStefano, you know, he's the art director. I don't really know anybody else in the project, but yeah, it's a good show. Didn't really know anything about it until I was offered the job, and then I picked up the first two seasons on DVD, and it's pretty funny. I was pleased. It's probably one of the funnest things I've ever storyboarded, so.
Do you enjoy working on cartoons?
I do, up to a point. The volume of work is really high, and the turnaround is quite short, so it's really intense. There's not much time or
Yeah,
because
I have a friend
else.
She's an animator, and she's an amazing illustrator, like a fantastic, beautiful illustrator, and she put out a comic, and it, you know, it garnered rave reviews, but she doesn't have any time to do comics ever because she's constantly, 13 hours a day animating.
Yeah, it's like that. But it's like seasonal work, so you do a year's work in 4 or 5 months, and then potentially you have some time to do your other projects as long as you're not too burnt out. So it's a question of pacing myself at this point. The money can be good, so it really makes a difference. And after being in grad school for 4 years, I haven't been earning for a while, so, it's pretty good on that front.
What is that degree going to earn you? Is it going to get you? Like, are you going to become a graphic designer for a big-name company? Like,
oh, no, I don't.
What are you going to be when you grow up, Pat?
No, I don't need an MFA to be a designer. No, and I'm not pursuing design at all.
It just adds a legitimacy to your fine art?
Well, if there was ever like a practical outcome that I was looking towards, it was the ability to teach, because I don't want to be freelancing for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And, as an author, I haven't, distinguished myself much. I hope to in the years ahead, but no, I mean, I may pursue further schooling, so I have interests completely outside of comic books that I'm also pursuing at the same time, so...
Like what?
Just research. So critical and creative writing. It doesn't really dovetail into the comic book thing very well. Some of it will. The thing is they all feed into one another. So it's just a question of finding the appropriate outlet for whatever interests. So, the degree was something that I did because I really needed to do it. I needed to have an outlet for other ideas and to explore other possibilities with the artwork, but it's a competitive world, and I'm 40 now, and there's a lot of young Turks out there who are, I can't keep up with that, so I'm going to eke out my own little niche in the world, hopefully, having an artistic practice that spans various forms of writing, some cartooning, and hopefully some gallery shows here and there, and teaching, so that's, I think, that would be really fulfilling. I just never felt satisfied trying to cram everything in my life into, 6 to 8 panels per page.
It just
doesn't really work. So.
So my last question is, how much is music an influence on your work?
Probably a lot. It's always been there. I'm not really as up on, what's going on in independent music now as I used to be. I'm still peripherally attached to it, but only remotely. But I listen to stuff that helps me kind of access
like what?
Spaces in my imagination. I guess a lot of stuff that I'm listening to now is stuff that's really withstood the test of time. So important periods for me were like...
This is University Radio. You need to name names.
Yeah, I'm about to, but it's more like eras or, like the early 70s for Roxy Music, David Bowie, Brian Eno. A lot of sort of stuff that would be considered proto-punk, I guess. Like British art rock and prog rock, kraut rock. And then the stuff around Bowie's Berlin period in the late 70s and early 80s. So I'd say like 1971 to 73 and 1981 to 83 are pretty big times. A lot of that stuff. Early punk and new wave, but it's hard to fit it into boxes because I see more strains of things that kind of go through time and they don't really line up really conveniently with those times, but yeah, a lot of that stuff. In terms of like stuff that's happening now, still a few years behind the times, like, I don't know, Deerhoof. I'm still listening to the new Pornographers, and I think for people, 10 years younger than me, that's like way out of date. So.
You're never too old to get into stuff.
No, I mean, there's stuff going on that I like, but it's a full-time job, and when you're 20-something, you can kind of...
Be obsessive, compulsive about it.
Well, you can dedicate yourself to it, and if you're at the radio station, you get lots of, perks and comps, and I don't know. And I'm not really active with, downloading stuff off the internet, so...
It's all word of mouth.
Yeah, and I'm just not... I'm kind of invested in other things, so it's not the first line, and I don't know. I'm a little ambivalent about a lot of the stuff I hear now. It's...
It's really rehashed. Like, my brother was really into The Clash and the Raveonettes and stuff, and so I was trying to get him a Christmas present, and he wanted this one band, and then the guy at the counter at Cheap Thrills was like, oh, well, if he likes this, then he might like these Crystal Stilts or whatever. So I'm listening to the Crystal Stilts, and, like, I got it for him, and I'm like, it's like the Smiths. They're not, there's nothing really all that original about it, you know?
Well, yeah, I don't know, like, originality is a hard thing to find out.
I find, you know, the Deers is a good answer, but I find they're heavier than the Smiths ever were.
Yeah, and I guess what I meant to say about originality is it's not hard to find now, it's just located in different places. It's more about how things are combined rather than, because you know, the Stills aren't... He sings a bit like Morrissey, and it's sort of got that density of the Smiths in a way, but it's quite different in a lot of ways. So I don't mean to just, you know, reduce it all to, it's, you know, all been done before. But I think there's something about a lot of the independent stuff, especially around Montreal, that it reminds me of Gary Panter calling the new wave of cartoonists the gentleman cartoonists.
Well, it's the whole Arcade Fire sort of,
I mean,
Baroque pop.
Yeah, they're not invested in the kind of, like, adversarial thing that punk rock was involved in, and trying to really define yourself or pick a team and hating what came before. It's much more kind of gentle. It's more like reform than revolution or something like that. And there's a lot of interesting stuff going on musically and lyrically, and it's a really rich and diverse kind of landscape, but at the same time, I just don't feel any sense of urgency about it. I feel like it's always going to be around. I can dip into it whenever I need to. And I'm not really into playing a keeping up with the Joneses thing in terms of musical fashion, because until something's kind of withstood the test of time, I'm just, you know...
There's no point.
Well, it's, you know, there's too many flashes in the pan, so to speak, and things that are interesting for the moment. But again, if I have limited resources, I want to invest it where I think I'm going to get the most return, so...
So do you listen to a lot of music while you're drawing, or...?
Sometimes.
Or silence?
It's only been in recent years that I've enjoyed what I'm doing enough to really indulge a lot of silence. I just don't even think about music anymore. I'm lost in what I'm doing. So.
Yeah, I don't know if that's an advent of getting older, though, because, like, me too.
Probably.
Like, I used to listen to a lot of music all the time. I used to need it when I went to sleep, and I'm not like that anymore. Like, I just, especially when I'm working, I find it, now it's distracting. It's like, turn this stuff off.
Well, yeah, and I've often, you know, you can spoil music that you like by having it associated with a task that you really hate. So, you know, if I'm working on something and it's just dreary, and, you know, it's long days, too, and you just run out of stuff. It doesn't matter how big your music collection is. You just lose your ability because it's emotionally charged, and it demands something of you. So, you know, and if you're not able to give it, it sort of feels like a drag. So, yeah, music's really important, and I think I tried to protect it from, you know, the things I hated about doing freelance work for a long time. So it's kind of nice to be able to listen to it again, because, yeah, the work I'm doing now is a pleasure to do. So, and school definitely made a big difference in just my attitude towards work and how I work, and feeling that I had a much bigger palette, or, you know, more possibilities open to me. So I didn't feel like I, again, had to cram all my ideas into one thing where they weren't really appropriate or well served. So,
well, thank you very much for the time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.